Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Anti-worker bills advancing in Florida and Texas. The game plan ending right to work in Michigan. Crucial week this week. Today on the show, we check in with the New York City Central Labor Council and the United Electrical Workers. Welcome to the Monday, March 20th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Vinny Alvarez is going to be our first guest on the show today. Vinny is the president of the New York City Central Labor Council. Website, real simple, nycclc.org. He is the first full-time president and the first Latino president of the council. He got that position back in 2011, was reelected in 2015 and 2019. He previously served as an assistant legislative director of the New York State AFL-CIO. Great guy. He's been on the show before. Lots of energy. And his background is IBEW. Been a member of the IBEW since 1990. Started his career with Local 3 in Flushing, New York, serving on numerous political campaigns, grassroots initiatives, negotiating committees. He's on a ton of committees, too. In fact, he is also on the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And right now, banking is the number one topic in America. I'm sure we could touch on that briefly. But what we're going to really delve into is a Climate Jobs New York. And this is a growing coalition of labor unions representing 2.6 million working men and women at the center of New York's economy. They're united around a shared goal of combating climate change while at the same time reversing inequality, income inequality. Their mission is to advocate for a clean energy economy at the scale climate science demands, create good, keyword is good, union jobs, and support more equitable communities and a more resilient New York. And he's going to explain the game plan on that, how that's actually going to happen. So we'll touch on that. We'll touch on the political climate, and we'll also talk briefly about a new law. Last time we had Vinny on the show, he was giving us a heads up on this, and the law has taken into effect, and it's called Carlos's Law, and it's named for a construction worker in Manhattan who was killed on the job. He was digging a trench, and the trench collapsed. And it turns out that deaths at construction sites, primarily in New York City, have reached a five-year high. Last year, 22 workers died at construction sites across the city. Now, this law, which is now in effect, punishes criminally negligent companies for workers' deaths with fines up to $500,000, $500,000. So we'll touch on that as well with Vinny Alvarez. Scott Slauson will be rejoining us later in the show. We had him on about maybe a month or two ago, and he comes to us from the United Electrical Workers. This would be Local 506, where he serves as president. He's been president for the past 9 years, representing the workers at the former General Electric Transportation Division, which is now called Wabtec. And they build locomotives that move the world. We talked about that the last time we had Scott on. But right now, as you know, trains and train derailments are in the news. In fact, we had the big one in East Palestine, Ohio, which is the center of national attention on rail safety and what they can do to stop all these derailments. And there have been, my gosh, at least a half a dozen here in the last couple of weeks. There was one on a Indian reservation about a week and a half ago that spilled 2,500 gallons of diesel fuel. And the numbers on this are quite astounding. There are around 1,000 train derailments in this country on an annual basis. A lot is being discussed right now on the bearings. I talked about this briefly on the show on Friday because, according to a federal investigation, overheated bearings were most likely the cause of the derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, and the industry is going to put more sensors in the tracks. We'll see what Scott has to say about that more as our second guest. Now, a brief look into the world of labor, the segment brought to you by the good folks at Boyd Watterson Asset Management. You can find more at boydwatterson.com. We're getting more and more information on what's going to happen here with the end of right to work in the state of Michigan. This is a huge story. Well, Governor Gretchen Whitmer said she will sign the repeal of that right to work law, even if it includes an appropriation, after pledging on the campaign trail to veto bills that feature spending as a strategy to block referendum votes. I didn't realize the complexity of this bill, but here's what they did. This is pretty slick. I got to hand it to the Democrats on this one. They added an appropriation of $1 million to the repeal legislation last week, which makes the policy referendum pretty much veto-proof. Opponents of the repeal, now they could still gather signatures to challenge the law on the ballot next year, but it would take a constitutional amendment instead of a referendum. There's a big difference there. A constitutional amendment would require twice the petition signatures, 446,000 instead of 223,000. Can it be done? Well, it depends how much money they have. They do have a lot of money. They can try to do this. But by next year, the question is, are they going to bother with it? So this is what Whitmer said. I have made a promise to restore workers' rights in Michigan. I have fought against the creation of this barrier in the first place. I did not ask the legislature to put that part into the bill, and it's certainly not on my agenda. But I'm going to sign the bill. Why? Because it restores workers' rights. So that's where we are right now. Now, tomorrow, the House and Senate in Michigan, this is the state house, they will reconvene to do some cleanup work on the bills. They got to make sure that the bills, the one that passed in the House, is identical to the one in the Senate. And this is typical. Now, here's the downside on this. Because they attach that money part, that $1 million, it's at least $1 million. This bill will not go into effect until the end of the legislative session plus 90 days. That being said, means we have to wait till the end of the year. The legislative session will end sometime in December. And then you tack on 90 days. So the repeal of right to work, if everything goes as planned, and it should, we will see the end of right to work in Michigan a year from now. It's going to take some time, but eventually it's going to happen. I got to hand it to the Democrats on that one. That was pretty slick. Add the money portion, and this way it scooted up for them to try to reverse it. Legislation that would weaken public sector unions advanced in Florida last week, where the bills are working their way through committees in the state Senate. The legislation would, number one, decertify unions unable to maintain membership levels of 60% of eligible workers. And number two, end direct deductions of union dues from employees' paychecks. The legislation, by the way, does not apply to law enforcement and firefighter unions. If the bills continue to advance in the Florida legislature, questions may arise as whether the Florida state constitution permits that legislation. The Florida state constitution declares that the right to bargain collectively shall not be denied or abridged. Now, the Florida Supreme Court interprets this provision to mean that the legislature must narrowly tailor any interference with the right to collectively bargain to a compelling state interest. This will be one to watch. I mean, Florida's a right-to-work state, been a right-to-work state for a long time, and they've got people in power. They got a super Republican majority there that does not like unions. In fact, one lawmaker went on record last week saying he wants to ban the Democratic Party from the state of Florida. That's how far to the right they are. We don't need two parties. Get rid of them. One more here. This is Texas. A committee last week in the Texas House considered legislation that would severely limit the ability of municipalities to regulate, including in labor and employment. The law would add a field preemption provision to laws governing finance, insurance, natural resource, labor, and occupations. It was filed in both the Texas House and the Senate in early February. The governor, Greg Abbott, has come out in support of the bill. The bill's sponsors frame it as a means of ensuring regulatory consistency and a way to tell cities and towns to stay in your lane. For instance, the law would preempt an Austin ordinance requiring construction workers be provided a 10-minute break for every 4 hours of work. So if you're helping the worker in your respective city, and you know how warm it gets in Texas, that would be illegal. Following a multi-year organizing effort, graduate students at the University of Chicago have overwhelmingly voted to unionize. University of Chicago joins a wave of new graduate student unions. And that trend is continuing all around the country. Some good news there. All right, we have to take a quick break. Vinny Alvarez, head of the Central Labor Council in New York City, coming up next.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Hi, this is Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, and I am a huge fan of Flash and America's Workforce Radio and podcast.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, always connecting people with good employment. And you can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go to New York City right now. Welcome, a fighter for workers. Man, this guy is a pistol. Vinny Alvarez is his name, and he is president of the New York City Central Labor Council and a longtime electrical worker, Local 3 IBEW in Flushing, New York. Lots going on in New York City, and this man has many, many hats. He is also a principal officer of Climate Jobs New York and the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, the AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust. Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition? That anniversary is coming up this weekend. Vinny Alvarez, how we doing, my brother?
We are doing good, Flash, and thanks for having you on, having me on again. It's good to talk to you.
All right, always a pleasure having you on the show. Let's talk about organizing in New York City. I know that's one of the things you want to get into. We're seeing a lot of organizing going on all around America. We got a union-friendly administration. Changing of the guard over at the Labor Department here with the exit of Marty Walsh. Let me ask you, let's start right there. I'm sure you've had a pretty good relationship with Marty over the years since you come from the trades. Maybe you could speak to that. What do you see happening there?
Well, organizing is a huge focus of the labor movement now. It comes from the top down, from the political side, certainly from the administration, the DOL. You mentioned Secretary Walsh and Julie Sue, who's going to be in as well, coming in. And Julie is just as supportive as Marty Walsh has been. And in the administration, seeing how, like, you have 60 million, roughly, Americans that say they would join a union tomorrow if they had the opportunity to do that. So we in the AFL-CIO, led by our president, Liz Shula, has really had a focus throughout the country, throughout our states, throughout our local governments and jurisdictions throughout the state, to really do everything that we can to support our affiliates in their efforts to extend those benefits to working people throughout the country. And certainly we're trying to do that here in New York City. So there's a lot of high-profile campaigns, and there's certainly some smaller campaigns. They're all important, though, because at the end of the day, we know working people are getting up, they're going to work, they're doing everything they can keep their heads above water, and you know they also want a collective voice at work, and make sure that they can help better their own situation, their own financial situation, as well as that, those of their families. So we're doing everything we can, certainly at the Central Labor Council, to support those efforts.
Well, you got the organizing campaign, and say you get organized, you got to get that first contract. That is very, very difficult. I mean, a good example is like the Amazon workers in in your area, Staten Island area, organized, and they've yet to get a first contract. Maybe you can speak to that as far as the difficulty and all the hoops that you have to jump through in order to get that contract. It's pretty cumbersome, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, we've had the problem. I try to talk about this often because I think it's a huge issue, whether you're talking about Amazon or we've seen also, of course, with Starbucks and real employer resistance by Howard Schultz. But here, even in New York with, you know, we have the musicians right now are on strike, Local 802 of the musicians for Distinguished Concerts International New York, DCINY. Those workers, they work in the pits at Carnegie Hall, places like Lincoln Center, and they've been trying to get a first contract over there. They formed a union 3 years ago, and here they are still trying to get a first contract. Hearst Union, Writers Guild of America East, they've been fighting for years now themselves. They've been fighting for the last 2 years, trying to get a first contract. These are big units, too, 500 members at Hearst Union. UAW over at Brooklyn Museum, they've been fighting for a first contract. So, I mean, we can go on, and there's more. Bustle Digital Group. Digital media has had a tremendous amount of organizing, which is taking place, and I really compliment, you know, the workers who've been out there fighting for their rights and working with the different unions, CWA, News Guild, with the Writers Guild of America East, but they've been fighting over at Bustle Digital Group for a first contract for 2 years. And then, of course, over at NBC, we have 200 NBC, MSNBC, and Today digital journalists who unionized 3 years ago, and they're still negotiating the first contract. And the MSNBC union, which is part of the Writers Guild of America East, a little confusion. They represent 300 writers, producers, and fact checkers, and they've been fighting over a year for first contract. So first contract in organizing is a huge issue here, which is, you know, one of the reasons why we're certainly supporting the protecting right to organize, continuing to support some sort of reform at the federal law, which could help these workers, help these workers get into unions and have a collective voice at work more easily.
So it's a policy issue here, and I'm just let me ask you. You know they reintroduced the Protect the Right to Organize Act, and the AFL-CIO's got a campaign going on right now. If you go to their website, AFLCIO.org, you can add your name to that. Now, we know this is going to be very, very difficult, and they had to introduce it in the Senate because it's not going to go anywhere in the House. But I'm wondering, if we had the PRO Act, what we just talked about right now, getting that first contract, that would change the dynamics of getting that first contract. Is that pretty much the case?
Well, it would do several things. But if you talk about that, that's one of the aspects of the PRO Act, and it's named, of course, after our former late president, Richard L. Trumka, the Richard L. Trumka Protecting Right to Organize Act. So the law would require employees to bargain in good faith with the unions, and they would put a timeline process on it. It would establish a process for reaching the first agreement when workers organize. It would utilize mediation and then, if necessary, binding arbitration to enable the parties to reach that first agreement. Because we know that part of this is the thing. We know that the stalling strategy, it's part of the tactic of the anti-worker corporations that are out there. I mean, we've seen these workers for two, you know, you just heard me rattle off a bunch of them just here in New York City alone. You know, we've seen them here for 2 years, for 3 years, some of them, and it's built into it. You know, they try to weigh down. They know it's costly. That time costs money. You have turnover in workers. It's just a way to kind of beat workers down and to make them discouraged, to make them give up. And we think it flies in the face of the federal law and the National Labor Relations Act, which reaffirms that it shall be a policy of the United States government to encourage collective bargaining, not just to remain neutral, make sure everybody's playing by the rules, but actually to encourage collective bargaining. So if we can get a process that could help speed things along and respect both, and respect the right that they have, the workers have in this process, we applaud the government, the Biden administration. As I said, Julie Sue, the DOL, the NLRB have really pro-worker representatives in there, and our national AFL-CIO is going to be doing everything we can to make sure that this is a big issue and this conversation at the federal level taking place.
Yeah, we got to stay on it. Well, you're fortunate to live in a city and a state with the incredibly good union density, especially when it comes compared to other states.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the numbers here. You're over 20% for the state of New York.
Yeah, and in the city where I do my work down in the five boroughs, we've been real fortunate because we've maintained density. It's always harder for technical reasons, for statistical reasons, to firm up the numbers. Locally, it gets a little easier if you start at the federal level, harder at the state level, difficult at the city level. But we've always represented at least one in four workers. Around one in four workers, it's probably closer to 27%. And that's with employment rising in New York City over the past decade. We have about 4.5 million workers in the city of New York. And we're really proud of the work that the unions are doing and have done in representing those workers, too. I mean, there's been some real big contract wins that we could talk about if you want, just to kick off the year, certainly with NYSNA and the nurses that they represented. But they, with those 30,000 nurses that they, from 12 hospitals that they were able to successfully negotiate a contract, look, they do a great job and in representing workers in this city. And we just, we wish that those benefits were extended to more workers. And we work on that as well.
Yeah, I referenced your name when that strike happened. It was maybe 6 weeks ago, Mount Sinai Hospital and Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. I mean, you got everybody together. I mean, solidarity was the key to that, wasn't it?
It was. That was a real high-profile strike, and it was at the beginning of the year. It was cold, but I got to tell you, those nurses, they have some courage, and the solidarity begins with them and the leadership over there at NYSNA. They did a terrific job. We jumped in and made sure that that the folks in the New York City labor movement, that working people, elected officials, community leaders were out there supporting them in their efforts to focus primarily on staffing, on patient care. That was the irony. You know, it was focusing on saying, we need more nurses in there if we're going to continue to provide the patient care that we want to provide as professionals in healthcare. And so that's what they were out there fighting for. They were able to successfully negotiate that agreement. You know, this shortage is a huge thing. But again, collective bargaining enabled them to be able to address that at the table, address the fact that we had 700 nursing shortages at Montefiore the week of the strike, 500 up at Mount Sinai the week of the strike as well. And so, you know, kudos to them. They did a great job. Labor movement stayed together. You know, some other ones, of course, that are taking place out there that we feel good about as well. 32BJ just avoided a strike with and they reached a 4-year deal. The building service workers up at the Bronx this past week. And over at Saturday Night Live, the post-production workers, they had a strike deadline, but they have reached a tentative agreement right now. So those are workers up there that work in post-production. And so, you know, we're happy that they're able to get those agreements. But boy, we know this is tough work, you know, that but working people coming together and standing in solidarity with each other are able to accomplish a lot.
Vinny Alvarez joining us on our live line today. He is president of the New York City Central Labor Council, which is all affiliated with the AFL-CIO, nycclc.org. Great website. Got to check it out. When we come back, we're going to talk about climate jobs, New York, also construction worker deaths in New York City. Later in the show, we're going to check in with Scott Slauson on behalf of the United Electrical Workers. We're going to talk about all these train derailments in the country. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Hello from the Communication Workers of America, District 4. We are a labor union representing a vast array of workers in different industries, including the Association of Flight Attendants, Telecommunications, CWA Passenger Services, Public Health Care, and Education Workers, the IUE, CWA Industrial Division, the National Association of Broadcast Employees, the CWA News Guild, not to mention our growing digital sector, and many others. If you're interested in organizing your work group or learning more about what it means to be CWA strong, visit our website at www.cwad4.org. That's cwad4.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at uaw.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least 6 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis. And give us a rating. We always appreciate those 5-star ratings, so please keep them coming. Let's go back to New York City, rejoin Vinny Alvarez. Vinny, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Vinny, I was reading some stats here about construction worker deaths in New York City, and primarily at non-union job sites. Last year, 22 workers died at construction sites. I know there's a lot of building going on in New York City. A lot of immigrant labor, and that's another subject in itself. But I'd like to reference the new law that went into effect, which punishes criminally negligent companies for those deaths, yeah. Construction workers' deaths. It's called Carlos's Law. Last time you and I talked on the show, I know that law was, I guess they were just working the details out. And it's now It's now law in the state of New York with fines up to $500,000. I was just wondering, obviously this is a step in the right direction, but as far as these non-union sites, I imagine the Central Labor Council's got to be pretty vocal about what's going on there. Can you speak to that?
Well, we have been in for years talking about in the city, talking about the dangers of the construction industry. And as you know, I come out of the construction industry, but also the unnecessary hazards which workers all too often are put under. Our Building and Construction Trades Council, led by our president, Gary LaBarbera, has done a great job every year at highlighting this. 80% of the deaths which we see on construction sites are immigrants without union representation. There's a construction worker that roughly dies every 5 or 6 days in the city. And look, construction industry is dangerous. It's a dangerous industry, but it doesn't have to be a deadly industry, which is all too often what we see it becomes. So this law, which the governor, to her credit, signed into a law back in December at the end of the year, it's going to increase those penalties by 5 times, and that will help be a deterrent, hopefully, against this really inherently dangerous business. Every year, Workers Memorial Day at the end of April, the Construction Trades Council hosts a mass over at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is really, I got to tell you, it's very moving. They do a hard hat mass for all the construction workers that die, and they put a chair for every up on the altar of St. Patrick's Cathedral with the hard hat for all those workers who die, and it's too many. Every year you go there and people say, I can't believe it. It's 15, it's 18, it's 20, it's 22, it's 23. You see the families, you know, mourn their loved ones. You see both unions and union employers, contract association, come and talk about what we can do to help improve safety. And there's a lot that we can do, but this will help create a deterrent that I think is necessary, because otherwise what we do is we see the bad actors out there, these bad employers, that they just write the cost of doing business, write exploitation into the cost of doing business in the workplace. And we can't have that. Yeah. Too many workers die every year unnecessarily. And that's what happened. Carlos, you know, it's hard to believe it was almost eight years ago. It was 2015 when Carlos Moncayo was killed on the job. But this will go a long way helping, you know, I think helping avoid some, you know, unnecessary injuries and deaths.
And unfortunately, I get the feeling that a lot of these contractors feel that immigrants are expendable. I mean, they figure, oh, you know, they don't need a union. They don't need safety precautions because there's somebody else ready to fill in their shoes. So that attitude has to go away. And hopefully this law, it's good that they put some teeth into this law. I mean, $500,000. Yeah. Yeah. That gets my attention. Definitely.
It does get. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, look, unions like the laborers that have been out there that represent a lot of these workers that we're talking about. I mean, there's, of course, there's a whole host of different unions, but they've done a great job at kind of leading the push here for Carlos' law and making sure that they can do what they can to try to prevent these accidents from happening in the future. And I think this will help. So, you know, again, it's always more work to do, but this is something that certainly we feel will be helpful, and we credit the governor for signing it into law.
Vinny, let's talk about Climate Jobs New York, and I know this is huge, and we're hearing a lot, especially with the policy coming out of Washington, the Inflation Reduction Act. So the federal government is putting money into this area and making sure that we create good union jobs. That's what we want, good union jobs. Can you speak to what's going on with the coalition that you're involved in?
For about 6 years or so in the city, we as a formal organization, we were doing, of course, coalition work before that. But the concept is really pretty simple. We have a dual crisis in this country of climate, for sure. We have climate change, which we have to address, but we also have a crisis of inequality. We can address both of them simultaneously, but not only helping to do what we can to reverse climate change and mitigate the effects of climate change and work on resiliency, but also create good jobs in this industry as this industry continues to build out and transition, and make sure that those jobs, wherever possible, are union jobs. And so, you know, we worked very hard at that over the years, and we continue to do at it. I think, and we work at it in the energy sector, we work at it in the building sector, we work at it in the transportation sector, we work on in a whole host of different ways. But I really think people, it's hard to wrap your mind around what a big undertaking this is going to be for society to transition to a clean energy economy, and the work that these that really that we all have to do, not only as a city and as a state and as a nation, but also as a society around the world, if we're going to make that transition. And we have to do it in a smart way. We have to protect existing workers. We have to make sure that the workers and the jobs that are created have the opportunity to unionize. We've done that here in New York. You know, we have a statute that in New York that, like for instance, in firstly in the offshore wind industry, but then it was broadened, that was signed into law for the renewable energy sector, that everybody, all the construction jobs that be have project labor agreements and a prevailing wage requirement, the operation and maintenance has to have a labor peace requirement in it, Buy American provisions on the supply chain. And we're working real hard with these developers to ensure that becomes a real thing. There's a tremendous amount, and again, this is really complex, rebuilding our grids that need to be rebuilt. Maintaining an existing supply of energy as we go through this transition, which is going to take a long time and a lot of years, make sure that we have an adequate supply of energy to meet the demand for energy that both consumers and businesses, you know, are going to need. If they're, to the extent that there's retraining, how do we retrain those workers? What does the just transition look like? A just transition to us doesn't mean that you don't, if somebody happens to lose their job or a job gets transitioned to a new industry, it doesn't mean we're going to give somebody a job, you know, 3 years from now, two states away. That's not a just transition. So we have to work on all these really complex issues, and it happens, as I said, at the city level, at the state level, at the county level, and in a whole many different types of policies which are being discussed and debated upon every day.
When you say this is going to take a long time, can you quantify that? And I bring this up because you're probably aware of where the automobile industry is right now. I think GM says they're not going to make any gas-powered right. vehicles after 2035. Well, you know what? That's a little over a decade away. I'm just wondering, are we going a little too fast on this? It sounds like you said we got to do this in a smart way. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I think the thing is, what you're going to have to do, it's like you're really going to have to manage this in a way. First, that always maintains an adequate supply of energy, okay, for the demand of energy that's needed. We don't need energy shortages. We don't need, you know, energy shortages that are going to result in spikes in prices on that, which is going to hit, you know, lower middle income workers the hardest, and businesses as well. We don't need shortages where there's just not an adequate supply of energy, period, for some people. That would be a problem. So you have to kind of, you know, we have an energy portfolio. You have to rebalance it, and it has to constantly be rebalanced in a way at these Department of Energy, at the state level. At the federal government has to be involved with this. We have 50 states, so you have different laws and different authorities and different agencies and different different energy companies which have to manage this. And so it's really complex, Flash. It really is. But I think as we go through that, and that's just from the energy perspective. From the workers' perspective, we want to make sure that these are good jobs that are created.
Yep.
We want to make sure that the jobs that are created are not, you know, low wage jobs where workers have no representation and no voice in the workplace. And the national AFL-CIO has really been strong, and our president, Liz Shula, has really been strong at making sure that we're fighting for that. And we're building up capacity in each of the states and coordinating with them to make sure that a lot of these companies are foreign companies that are coming in here, particularly like in the offshore wind industry. They're developers that have been doing this in countries around the world. Now they're coming here. We want to make sure that they have strong labor policies in place to ensure that we have We have the right to representation in the workplace. We don't want to create an industry that not only pursues the worthy goal of increasing the production of renewable energies here in the country, and hopefully that'll get the price of energy down and bring us to greater energy independence in the long run, but also that these jobs are good union jobs as they're created.
That's exactly what we want. Vinny Alvarez joining us on our live line today. Vinny, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, NYCCLC.org. Great website. Do check that out. Always enjoy getting your perspective on things. And I know you got a lot of hats that you're wearing. I'm going to let you run because you're a busy, busy guy. Let's keep in touch on all of these issues and more down the road. Okay, brother?
Well, Flash, thanks for having me on. I always appreciate being here, and I appreciate everything that you're doing for working people.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Scott Slauson on behalf of the United Electrical Workers right here on America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation. Let's go to Erie, Pennsylvania and join Scott Slauson. We had Scott on the show a couple months back, and he's with UE Local 506. It's the United Electrical Workers, UELocal506.com. Based in Erie, Pennsylvania, they have about 1,400 members. And last time we talked with Scott, he was talking about how they build locomotives. Well, guess what? Trains are in the news. They continue to be in the news. We had that horrific derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, at the beginning of February, and they're still unwinding that. It looks like it's overheated bearings there. But the statistics are quite astounding. There are about 1,000 train derailments every year in America. Now, there's a lot of trains running every day, so I don't know how that figures into things, but everything is under the microscope right now. We decided to bring Scott to the table to unwind what's going on. Scott, what's your take on what's happening with these train derailments? Is it the fact that they're not doing enough maintenance? We're hearing about these bearings. I mean, you know about trains. What's your opinion here?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. As far as, you know, the train derailments, I mean, there's a lot of factors that come into play. I think a lot of it is the railroad industry itself, right? The rail industry itself. When you deal with accidents, you deal with usually it's a series of events that leads to a point of culmination. And I think that's what we're seeing here. As far as the rail carriers themselves, I mean, there's been a lot of push on precision train control. And I think that that's playing into it. I think that reduced workforce inspections and everything else are also playing into it. I mean, the the people are actually, the workers are actually being given much less time to do the inspections. The maintenance is suffering because of it. And, you know, just simply the way they load the trains now with the precision train control is playing into it as well, as well as lobbying against safety features. I think that all plays into it.
You just mentioned loading the trains. That's interesting. What's going on differently with loading the trains that might be the cause of some of these derailments right now, Scott?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with precision train control, what you're saying is as little downtime as possible, right? So when you're loading trains, you're going to load them in the same order you want to unload them. And sometimes what ends up happening is we're putting the heaviest cargo to the rear. So when there is an accident or some semblance of an accident that could occur, generally what happens is if you've got all the weight in the rear, just like a semi on the highway, right? You don't want all the weight in the rear. You want more weight up front. You get a jackknife situation, or in this case, an accordion situation, which leads to the accident being far more severe than it would have been. As well as reduced inspection times. I mean, generally, the workers were given, you know, somewhere around 45 seconds to a minute to inspect each car, and in some cases, that time is down to 12 seconds. So there's a lot at play there, and you know, all these things lead to an accident.
Now, as far as loading goes, is it kind of done with no strategic plan in mind? You mentioned the heavy cars at the end. Isn't that something that they can correct almost overnight?
You would think, but there's really no regulation that says they need to. And so that's part of the problem, right? You think about airplanes in the air. The government regulates that. You think about the tractor trailers on the roads, heavily government regulated. Trains aren't necessarily regulated that way. So, you know, there's a lot that needs to be looked into, and honestly, a lot that needs to be addressed. As far as the strategic piece of loading a train, the strategy falls on the rail industry to figure out what needs offloaded first. So, you know, whatever's going to be offloaded first goes to the rear of the train. And if it happens to be your heaviest cargo, and in some cases, these trains are almost 2 miles long, you know, that's what's going to happen. And it's all in the name of speed and efficiency for the railroad. And the bottom line comes down to money. So it's not necessarily the safest way to do things, but it's the way they're doing them. And then on top, you know, you have the braking systems, which are antiquated because the rail industry lobbied against safer brakes.
So, Scott, let's pick up on the braking situation that you mentioned, because in the East Palestine, Ohio case, I know the bearings apparently were at fault, and they heated. They overheated to well over 200 degrees. And at that point, they couldn't stop the train. Can you speak to that part there? And apparently, well, what do you know about these bearings? I guess they heat up very rapidly when they go bad. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It's metal on metal, and what you're dealing with is high friction. And, you know, the higher the friction, obviously, the quicker something's going to heat up. You know, as far as the braking systems go, years ago it was proposed that all trains be equipped with electronic brakes. And, you know, companies like NS, although they admitted that in emergency situations they could stop a freight train much faster, they lobbied against them because of cost. So what it come down to is we put money over safety. And in case like, you know, what happened in East Palestine, and not just there, I mean, we're seeing a high frequency of train derailments here recently. Of course, they're grabbing more attention because of what happened in East Palestine. But you know, this is the trend that's going to continue to progress if we don't start putting some more strict safety regulations on rail itself.
So at one time in America, Scott, are you of the opinion that the trains were a whole lot safer before because of federal regulations, which kind of were whittled away over the years? Is that kind of what happened here?
I don't know if they've been whittled away, but what I would say is, like any industry, they lobby against change, especially change that's going to cost them money. I think trains have the ability to be much safer than they are, but I think that the you know, the bottom line is that when you have powerful forces lobbying against law change to make things better or safer. Let's face it, the bottom line comes down to the shareholders, and the rail industry is really only interested in pleasing its shareholders.
Yeah,
like many businesses, for that matter.
Right. Yeah, Norfolk Southern, I mean, among all the rail companies out there, they are the most profitable. And they're, yeah, and it's Wall Street boys, you know, it's a bottom line. Scott, if you don't mind, you mentioned this precision scheduled railroading, which really kind of pulls back the workforce. And I know during the pandemic, they lost a lot of workers. I recall reading on the show, there were like 45,000 workers that kind of like disappeared. A lot of them took early retirements. Some of them were let go. And they only hired, and I don't know where we are with it right now, they only hired about 10% of them back. So that, well, for instance, that train in East Palestine, Ohio, I believe there were 3 crew members on it. And I know the rail industry has been lobbying to get it down to 1. Which would have been a true disaster. But in the scheme of things, that amount of people, I mean, that's a lot of people to be missing from the rail industry right now. That probably would have changed things, perhaps, with all these derailments. I mean, 1,000 derailments every year. I'm just wondering if, is that an acceptable type of thing in America in 2023?
Yeah, I would say that you know, it's a statistic that hasn't changed much over the years, but is it acceptable? No. I mean, now grant you, some of these derailments are very minor derailments in their classification, but you know, when you play that game continuously and say, well, it's 1,000, but 900 of them or 950 of them were minor derailments, right? It's like playing with fire. At some point, you're going to get burned, and that's what we saw in East Palestine. And yes, I would say the reduced workforce in the rail industry is significantly played into these accidents, their frequency, and what's happening, you know, with reduced inspection times and maintenance. And I think that it's a trend that we're going to see continue unless, you know, we get a little more aggressive in our approach to, you know, not just the maintenance of the trains and how they're handled, but how they're loaded, as well as the size of them. I mean, when you're dealing with a freight train that's 2 miles long, just the weight alone is unfathomable.
Yeah. I'm just wondering here, is the fact that what happened in East Palestine, which was horrific, and I feel bad for the people there because they can't even sell their homes. I mean, these are people that remodeled their homes. They spent a lot of money. They like where they're living, but now they're dealing with this toxic mess over there. But I'm just wondering, do you think that this is a wake-up call, that the federal government is going to say, okay, we got to do something. We cannot let this happen anymore to a community like that because of the lack of regulations over the years, because of the whittling away of those regulations. You think that we're going to see some positive change? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I certainly hope we do. This needs to be a wake-up call. You know, trains, most efficient form of transportation on land, bar none. I mean, it's definitely a game changer when it comes to moving goods, cargo, people. I think that it's something that needs to be looked at very seriously, and I do think that some regulation needs to come down. I mean, there's no excuse as to why we derail 1,000 trains a year. And there's really no excuse to have a catastrophic failure like we saw in East Palestine. Nobody, no community should ever be subjected to that. When you think about the sheer amount of locomotives that are out there running our tracks, which is, you know, a staggering number, people don't really understand. It runs around 26,000 locomotives are out there pulling freight at any given time. When you think about that and the potential for what happened in East Palestine, you have to sit back and say, we're obviously doing something wrong and we need to figure out what that is. And we need to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And, you know, if it means that the railroads are going to have to invest some money instead of investing in their shareholders, then that's what needs to happen.
There you go. Scott Slauson, president of United Electrical Workers Local 506, based in Erie, Pennsylvania, 1,400 members strong. UELocal506.com is their website. Scott, you take care. I appreciate your concern and your opinion here. We'll stay in touch on this issue, okay, brother?
Sounds perfect. Thank you so much.
That'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the Ohio Federation of Teachers and the News Guild. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.